Welcome. It's good to see each one of you. I'm David Goa, the director of the Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life of the University of Alberta, based at the Augustana campus, about an hour from here. It's a singular pleasure to be here at King's again. It's always enjoyable to do the work we do together. And I'm delighted that we have Steve Bynum here to speak with us today and to engage us in a conversation. Steve and I met at a monastery. The Reformed Church hasn't yet gotten around to monasteries, I don't believe. You're working on it, though. We met at a monastery where we have mutual friends. And one of our good friends was diagnosed with cancer, and we were with him in a hospital while he was being checked on. And we sat waiting, and I turned to Steve and I said, what's going on in America with your extraordinary president? I want to suggest something to you that has occurred to me. And given who you are and where you stand, maybe you can disabuse me of this, or maybe you can speak to it in a way that that only you can speak to it. I had been troubled by what seemed to me to be President Obama's two-week honeymoon. Normally, American presidents get a bit more than that. But it seemed to me that within 2 weeks, even the liberal media in the United States was expecting of him things that were impossible from that chair. And I was just astonished by it. Astonished by it, I guess, because I was so moved by the fact that America had come to this moment in life, this extraordinary moment. I mean, on the evening of his election, I said, God bless America with all my heart. I'd lived in Chicago in the 60s, and I had a little glimpse of what racism can mean in a community and how awful it is. On every single level. It was heartbreaking to me. So I suggested to Steve, I queried, does this have something to do with what it means to be a man and black in America? And the fact that there's a whole bunch of codes. Or, as Steve has put it, there's a mask that is put on you, a mask that sometimes you don't even know you have, a mask that sometimes you take on yourself, a mask that is unbelievably difficult to take off and unbelievably difficult to help people see that it is not on. I thought back at that conversation of our own little... You know, here in Canada, we have a very big country and a very small nation. And I thought about my most enjoyable sports experience, coaching soccer with my children on the team. And when my expertise ran out, which was fairly quickly, a young neighbor man, I changed his diapers when he was small, actually. Wonderful athlete. He joined me coaching the team. He had been adopted into the family, and so just a wonderful person. And I thought I would just leave the coaching to him. But after a few games, I had a sense that I couldn't do that, that I had to stay on. So I got designated the spiritual coach. SC, responsible for blessing shoes, for cursing at appropriate moments, all those spiritual tasks that we have, for things like intimidation, talking back, the usual sort of stuff. My young friend was a wonderful athlete. He was also black. And I noticed that in the soccer games, if there was conflict, or if the referees weren't doing their job, or if the other coach was destroying the beautiful game, it may be necessary to intervene in some creative sort of way, which I spent time dreaming up. But that my good young friend would never do that. And I realized that in our lovely city, with its very soft, at least we think it's soft often, racism, he had learned at a very young age that the one thing he could not do was raise his voice. The one thing he could not do was push back. The one thing he must do was back off. So I stayed on as the spiritual coach in order to encourage, in order to bless shoes, and in order to occasionally stand in the breach and get myself kicked out of the game. So that led me to this reflection about what was going on in America. And on that occasion, Steve began to talk in a way that I found extraordinarily moving. And I said to myself, I would really like you to hear this, because it is a dimension of American life and of that wonderful country which has elected its first president who is black. It is a dimension of what goes on in the minds and hearts of that world that we need to understand in order to understand what unfolds. So I'm really delighted you're here and that you're able to speak with us. Steve has used the term mask in his title. As some of you no doubt know, the word person is the word in that ancient language for mask. How is it that we turn human beings, even human beings who are remarkable and in prestigious positions, how is it we turn them into a mask, into something which is no longer human, into a symbol upon which we can attach all of our fear and sometimes all of our most awful desires? So, Steve, I'm delighted you've come to talk about this. I know this is not an easy matter, and we're grateful.
I want to thank my white soul brother for that introduction. And you know, he's my soul brother for a number of reasons. We share the same Eastern Orthodox faith. But beyond that, soul is something that has very little to do with color, very little to do with what you eat, very little to do with how you dance or what you wear. Soul is about the essence of a person. Soul is about the ability to have empathy and sympathy, to have passion and compassion, to be able to look into a person's eyes and see the reflection of yourself. And if you can do that, you have soul. It also didn't hurt that David spent a number of years on the West Side around a lot of black people. But even if he hadn't, he is one of the most soulful people I will ever know. And I am privileged to call him friend, and you are privileged to have him here. And I thank him for inviting me. This is going to be difficult, and I want you to bear with me, because in that conversation we were having in that hospital waiting room, a lot of things that I had buried came to the surface. And there were points in the conversation where the emotion was beginning to rise up in me, not in anger towards David, but in what I had been able to put aside, what you do when you become a husband and a father and you get into the sort of monotony of life and you're cloistered and you're surrounded by distraction. And then you forget. You forget from where you came. You forget about those people whose shoulders you stand on. You forget about those experiences that traumatized you, that affected you, that impacted you, but that you still carry with you, and they still present themselves in varying and unexpected ways. The funny thing I remember about that conversation is that when we were talking, David was staring at me. He was deciding, do I talk about this? Do I bring this up? I don't want to offend him. Oh, to hell with it. And then he goes for it. And I appreciate that honesty of spirit, because today what I hope is that you don't spend as much time listening to me blather on as you engage with me in a conversation. And what I demand of all of you in this room is the same thing I will demand of myself. Speak authentically and speak what you feel is true without worry of offending or being offended. I will do that. And I hope you will do the same. Because when this started out, it was going to be a speech. And then I began to think about all these instances, all these occurrences and events during the Obama administration, from the time that he announced his candidacy for president in Springfield, Illinois, where Abraham Lincoln announced his candidacy in February of 2007, all the way to when he was elected, to that 1 week honeymoon that he had. David says it was 2 weeks. I cut it in half. It was actually one. To the legislative accomplishments that he tried to put forth, as he is accused of trying to turn the United States into Canada, as if though that is something to be ashamed of or fearful of. I personally think it's something to be proud of. To now the reelection cycle and what all of that means, and the importance of a potential second Obama administration. And so I want you to take this personal journey with me. It is an emotional journey, but it is a fruitful journey, and it is a journey that I'm privileged to take with you. I asked David to say a few things about personhood because in the African American experience, and I should preface this by saying that I am fully aware and acknowledge the difficulties that women have had to endure in Western society. I am not insensitive to that. Misogyny is just as much a blight on our journey together in North America as racism. But for this particular conversation, I ask that you pardon me that I focus on the experience of the black man, because that experience is iconic in American life, in identifying America and how America is identified from abroad. And so I beg your forgiveness in ignoring the plight and the struggle of women on this continent. I want to start from the beginning. It's important that we start from the beginning, because personhood and the denial of personhood to people of color, especially men of color, is so significant because it was encoded into law, encoded into our institutions, encoded into our media and encoded into our culture and our lifestyle and how we set up and established our societies in North America. Since slavery, the denial of personhood was vital to controlling the black family. The slave master would not allow the black man to discipline his children. The slave master would undercut and dehumanize the black man and belittle his authority at every turn. This was not based solely on hatred. As a matter of fact, hatred had very little to do with it. It was a systemized means of control. Because in a paternalistic society, if you control the man, you control the culture. The salvation of the culture always comes through the woman, but the control of the culture is through controlling the man. The slave master would take the male slave's wife to bed. The slave master reserved the right to sell the man's children and wife and spouse's property as chattel. These transactions and these actions were not always about emotion. They were about means of control, as I stated before, and not necessarily about economic benefit. And so that inability of the black male to speak, that inability for that black male to defend himself, that inability of that black male to express, to emote, to have full personhood and humanity, is at the heart of the black experience, was at the heart of the black experience then. And then it occurred to me that it is at the heart of the black experience even today, even for the most powerful man on the earth. And so I think about my ancestors, whom I thank for bringing me to this point. I think about Jesse, Abraham, and John Bynum. John Bynum was my great-great-grandfather. My family hails from Memphis, Tennessee. And they were extraordinary men for their time because though they were born slaves, they became free men. And they were business owners. They owned horses. They raised horses. And it was a vibrant and successful business. Well, that was something that could not be allowed in that day and age. There were those who were jealous. Those were black and white. And there were those who felt that it was not appropriate for African Americans to control their destiny in such a obvious and, I'll use the word, and you'll hear this word time and time again, uppity manner. Because to step outside of that paradigm of personhood that's been defined for you by the culture is considered arrogance, haughtiness, being uppity. And so you have a choice in wearing that mask. You can either express who you truly are, express your brilliance, your intelligence, your beauty, be it inner or outer, and be considered haughty and arrogant, or you can step back, hide yourself, and be considered docile or even imbecilic. Or you can scream. When we're happy, we laugh. When we're sad, we cry. When we're angry, we scream. We all do. It's part of being a human person. That basic fundamental right was denied. And we got so good at it as a culture in North America that at a certain point, like the elephant that you stake into the ground with a chain, becomes so accustomed to his enslavement that once you remove the stake, the elephant still does not move outside of the area, the reach of that chain. We as African Americans became self-regulating. We had the ability to suppress ourselves, the ability to program ourselves to instinctively hide for the sake of survival. But John, Jesse, and Abraham did not do that. And so something had to be done about it. And so a group of men, respected men in society, I think it's important to say, and we'll, as we go forward, we'll have to acknowledge that it's easy to look at Southern people or Klansmen in hoods or Nazis in their uniforms and go, bad, evil, and dump all of our disgust upon them. It's hard to acknowledge that this same ugliness is in all of us. It exists in our culture, in our society, in our institutions, and even if we don't proactively oppress, even if we don't aggressively enslave, to do nothing and just participate in that society that's been set up for you when you have white privilege makes you just as guilty. Many good people in Germany did not turn Jews in. They did not oppress Jews. Some of their best friends were Jews. But when the day came to be accountable, they looked away, or they hid, or they said nothing, or they denied. And they were just as guilty as those very soldiers that threw Jews into the ovens. And so the examples that I'm going to use, they're not going to be your typical Southern hicks. They're not going to be the people that's easy to heap scorn upon. They're going to be respected people of our institutions, of our society, who embraced this hysteria behind the election of the first black man to lead the free world. So back to John, Jesse, and Abraham. A group of men got together, judges, respected people, hiding. Some of them didn't hide at all. And they went to the ranch. After numerous attempts to get them to sell or intimidate them into selling or leaving, to kill them and take the land. They had no recourse, my ancestors, because they couldn't call the police. They couldn't go to the law because some of the very men that were there were of the law. And a shootout ensued. A number of white men were killed. At that point, they had no chance for survival. Jesse and Abraham fled, left their horses, left their land, left my inheritance behind. Abraham went to San Francisco to work in construction. Jesse fled to Texas, changed his name to Palmer. Abraham changed his name to Brown. But my great-great-grandfather, John, who's 6'9", stayed behind because his wife was too ill, and he would not leave her. And when they were going to seize upon him to kill him, they had mercy because of his wife. Not because she was ill, but because she nursed about half of the men who were in that mob. Because that was a common thing for black women to take care of white babies. And in most cases, the black woman was more of a mother to the children than the actual birth mother. And so they spared him, but they told him, you have to leave and never come back. So I think about them and their inability to live a full life, to participate in this society, to work hard, and to pass on that legacy to their descendants. When we try to think about what are the root causes of the dysfunction of African American life, that's a big part of it, the inability to inherit. I think about my grandfather, Cleveland Bynum. My heart is very heavy right now because 20 years ago he passed away from Parkinson's disease. He was my hero. He was a powerful man. Took no prisoners, took no guff, but was as sweet as pumpkin pie. He would never let you know it. I'll never forget, and there was one time when we were going to go to Memphis, Tennessee, which is where my mother and my father's family come from. And some gentlemen were supposed to come to fix the furnace. They were late. And if you know anything about that generation, that's the one thing you cannot be, is late. Ultimate sign of disrespect. So my grandfather, he's huffing and puffing, he's stomping back and forth. Where are these guys? Where are these guys? They finally show up. It's two white men. Now understand that in Chicago during this time in the 70s, Chicago as it is today was a very segregated city. And there was a certain privilege to being white, unlike a lot of cities in the United States. And so to speak up or speak disrespectfully to a white man if you were black was still dangerous territory. So my grandfather said, come here, like he would to me like I was a child. Stand in front of me. These two white men stood in front of me. And he read them the riot act, just like he would do me. And they sat, then he stood there and all they said was, yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're sorry, sir. We're sorry, sir. Forgive us, sir. We understand, sir. You're right, sir. Yes, sir. It blew me away. Then he said, I have to go to Memphis. Come back another time. And we left. Extraordinary. And so I have this example of this powerful man who raised me from birth. Because he chose to, not because he had to. And I think, why was he so vocal? Why was he even more angry than he'd ever been? What was it about that moment that set him off? And I think it has to do with the fact that he was screaming then because he could not scream when he was younger. When he quit the fifth grade so that he could go pick cotton to take care of his brothers and sisters and his mother because his father ran out on them. He had to take a lot in order to survive. And with that, with very little education, he comes from the South after the war and that great migration. And he comes to Chicago, starts as a dishwasher at the VA hospital, and worked his way up to supervisor. By the time he retired in 1984, a man who could barely read. There was no way on God's green earth he was going to take any more guff from any white people at any time anymore. And so we come to Barack Obama. Forty-fourth president of the United States. One of the most extraordinary feats ever accomplished, if you ask me. And it was like a storm had swept through. It wasn't like Barack Obama spent years in the public eye where people were familiar with him and he went through the appropriate machinery and politics and then it was his turn to run and then he ran. No, he was this little known state senator who was fortunate enough to run against a gentleman who would pimp his wife out at sex clubs. By the way, the wife was Jeri Ryan. She played Seven of Nine on Star Trek. Her husband was the senatorial candidate. Then it came out that he would make her go to sex clubs with him. And so this person with the Muslim-sounding name that no one heard of became a United States senator. And I said, no way he'll win. No way. Osama sounds too much like Obama. Won't happen. But he won. And then he gives a speech at the Democratic National Convention that set the world on fire. I don't know how many of you saw that or that speech. And all of a sudden, he'd arrived. No one knew who this man was. And then in February 07, he decided to run for president. Why? I have no idea. Hillary Clinton was the incumbent, and it was hers to lose. Who would be foolish enough to run against the Clinton machine, to run against the former president of the United States and his friends and cronies, and expect to win? Oh, he's just running because, well, you know, he wants to get practice when he's going to really do it in 4, 8, 12 years. But all indications were that he was serious, and he intended to be president. And so now you have this man who's mysterious, that no one knows about, who does not fit in the paradigm of who African Americans are understood to be. He wasn't born in the continental United States. He's born in Hawaii. He wasn't raised in poverty. He was raised by white grandparents. His mother was this bohemian professor who traveled all over the place. He had a global understanding of the world. There was a global presence in his life and his Indonesian stepfather. And so he was not raised in the isolation of American exceptionalism. So he wasn't bright enough to understand that the things that he ended up doing, you don't do. He didn't understand that. And so now you have a situation in the stereotypical paradigm to where he's so other that in proper company, it's not polite to utter the word nigger. There'll be no N-words today. So you call him a Nazi, a communist, a fascist. You compare him to Hitler and to Stalin and to Mussolini, and you quake in fear that he's going to take our country away from us. You question whether he was even born in this country. You call him Kenyan. There was criticism that he had this affinity towards Kenyan anti-colonialists, as if being against colonization is a bad thing. And so he had the audacity, he wrote a book, Audacity of Hope, to dream, to hope, to be more than what the paradigm would allow. But that all came at a price, because as a result, he had to experience the emotional and psychological castration that all black men must endure in order to ascend in Western society. And I empathize, and more than empathize, I live it. I, like the president, I can't emote. I'm 6'6". When I was growing up, I slumped with my shoulders. I speak softly. I always was very, very aware that, you know, don't intimidate, don't offend, don't make them frightened of you. They're frightened of you, Steve. Don't make the white people frightened of you. People in general, because of my size, but more so when I decided as a young black kid on the south side of Chicago, I want to be an aerospace engineer. Then I took advanced calculus and said, no, that's not going to happen. But I ended up going to the University of Notre Dame. I was one of the first football players from the Chicago public school system to be recruited at Notre Dame in 50 years. Now, I knew very little about Notre Dame. I'd heard of Newt Rockne. I knew nothing about it. They came looking for me. I didn't ask for it. And it was considered such a strange thing. People would ask me, why are you going to Notre Dame? And then when I got to Notre Dame, people would ask me, why do you want to be an aerospace engineer? And then when I changed my major and decided that I wanted to go into the liberal arts, and I went to visit my friend in Rome, because the architecture program at Notre Dame is a 5-year program. They spend the third year in Rome. Why did you go to Rome? Why did you go to Rome? Why would anyone go to Rome? It's Rome. Why would anyone go to Notre Dame? It's a top-tier university. There aren't very many African-American producers in public radio. Why did you do that? Because it's really great working for public radio. Because really smart people work there and they tell really interesting stories. Why do you listen to public radio? And so that's where when it became clear to me that I also wear the mask at a certain level, not compared to his, as he does. Because I have to hide who I am. I can't allow my natural brilliance to show. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. I just mean whatever it is inside of me that makes me what I am, I can't reveal that because it frightens people. This is Emmett Till. In the mid-1950s, he went to Money, Mississippi. Every summer he went to Mississippi, like I did. I went to Memphis, Tennessee to go visit all of my cousins. My grandmother was one of 14 children. I had a lot of cousins. My father's family was also in the same area. I had a ton of relatives. It was the joy of my life to go to Memphis every year and ride in the pickup truck and watch, well, it was a traumatizing moment, watch them slaughter a hog and see the whole process. I didn't eat pork for a year after that. Oh. But one day, Emmett was at a country store, and the wife of the owner, was a 21-year-old woman, he's 15 years old, good-looking guy, he goes in with one of his cousins, and then allegedly he whistles at the woman, says, hey, baby, or flirts with her. We're not really clear on what happened, if anything happened at all. But then I would say, so a 15-year-old kid is obnoxious and says, hey, baby. So what? Slap him in the face for being obnoxious. Fine. That's not what happened. His cousin snatched him out of there, and they made a bolt. He doesn't know what's going on. What's wrong with you? What's happening? We have to get out of here. Because that cousin understands what's going to happen or what could happen. That cousin understands the line that Emmett crossed when he flirted with this white woman. So they ran back to their great uncle's house. Moses Wright, they called him Mose, Uncle Mose. About three nights later, the woman's husband and his half-brother show up at Mr. Wright's house. Where's that boy? What boy? Where's that nigger? And Mose says, he's back there. And they take Emmett out of his bed and drag him to a farm where they proceeded to beat him to a pulp, gouged out one of his eyes alive, shot him in the head, and killed him. Tied a wire around his neck, tied that wire to a 32-kilogram cotton gin fan, and floated him up the Tallahassee River where he slept. When the body was found, he did not resemble anything human. That was intentionally done. Because he transgressed, he lost what little right he had to humanity. And so they wanted to set an example. This is what happens when you dare to be fully human. When the body came back to Chicago, his mother's from Chicago, she insisted on an open casket because she says, I want the world to see what they did to my baby. This is disturbing. I'm going to leave that up there. If you need to look away, look away. Emmett's death ignited the civil rights movement. There was an outcry. Local papers in Mississippi even criticized this. But when Northerners began to speak up and it became a national story, and African Americans in the North began to speak out because in the South they could not speak, they had to remain silent. Then there was a turn, and the community began to side with the murderers. But eventually all of the national publicity led to a trial of the husband and the brother-in-law. The two killers were on trial, and one of the most historic moments I think in American history, for African Americans, but for all of us in North America, came when Mose Wright was put on the stand. And Mose Wright was asked to identify the man that asked him, "Where is your nephew?" When Mose Wright stood up and enacted defiance and enacted bravery that shook the world at that time, he looked, he pointed at the husband and said, "Thar he." It stunned everyone in the courtroom. That he showed up is one thing. That he spoke is another thing. But that he looked at a white man and pointed at him and said, "I accuse you," was more than anyone could bear. Mose Wright had to leave Money, Mississippi, never to return. But it was a watershed moment. And in that moment, black people began to scream. Interestingly enough, Rod Serling, writer of The Twilight Zone, familiar, wanted to do a script. He wanted to write a story about the murder of Emmett Till and the acquittal of the two men that killed him. But the sponsors of the show he wanted to write it for said, "It's too hot. We can't touch it." African Americans wrote in and who heard rumors of it and pleaded and begged, "Please do this story. Please." Because, you know, in order to speak, a white man must speak for you. You're not allowed to have a voice of your own. Twice he tried to have this script turned into a television episode. But the White Citizens Council in the South, that was a racist, segregationist group, wrote thousands of letters to potential sponsors. And they said, "No, we can't do this." By the time the episode Noon on Doomsday aired, the victim had been transformed into an old Jewish pawnbroker in New England, and his killer was a neurotic malcontent who was protected from conviction by his neighbors. And so the ability to scream was taken away. I should also say that years later, the two men who were emboldened by Double Jeopardy admitted to the killing. And so we move forward in time to another icon.
"We're tackling something big here, Becky. If we fail, no one will try again for 20 years. It seems our boys, but what do you think, Becky?"
"Why, right. Think you've got just enough to play the game no matter what happens? They'll shout insults at you, they'll come into your spikes first, they'll throw at your head."
"They've thrown at my head for a long time.
Hold on a player at the heel important game. Suppose I collide with you at second base, and when I get up, I say, 'You dirty black so-and-so.' What are you doing?"
"Mr. Rickson, do you want a ball player who's afraid to fight back?"
"I want a ball player with guts enough not to fight back. You got to do this job with base hits, stolen bases, and fielding ground balls, Jackie. Nothing else. Now I'm playing against you in a World Series, and I'm hot-headed. I want to win this game. So I go into you fight first. You jab the ball in my ribs, and the umpire says, 'Now, I glare.' All I can see is your black face, that black face right over me. So I haul up and punch you right in the cheek. What do you do?"
"Mr. Ricky, I've got two teams."
"Good."
So that was a meeting in August of 1945 between Branch Rickey, the general manager and president of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and of course, Jackie Robinson. Now, it's important to state that this was a 1950 movie called The Jackie Robinson Story. This is not how that meeting went. The actual meeting was 3 hours of shouting and screaming between the two men. Because Jackie Roosevelt Robinson was a very proud man, a very competitive man. And the idea that he should let people spit in his face, dig their spikes into his heels when sliding into second base, that he should tolerate when an umpire makes a blatantly bad, intentional bad call, or when a pitcher throws at his head, that he should say nothing, was just inconceivable to him. Branch Rickey had him investigated, which he admitted, which is one thing that caused the meeting to blow up. We checked his background. Branch Rickey knew and understood that Jackie Robinson would be the first and potentially the last if it went wrong. The only thing he found in his background was that he had been court-martialed because he had protested against, when he was in the Army, soldiers who were black soldiers who were forced to sit on the back of the bus when they had to transport. That court-martial was eventually thrown out and overturned. But there was a deal cut. Branch Rickey said, for 3 years, you cannot respond no matter what happens to you. No matter the death threats you get, every time Jackie Robinson went out to the plate, he didn't know if there was a man in that crowd that had a gun to kill him. Every time he left his family, he didn't know if he was going to see them when he came back, whether they'd be kidnapped or killed, or he'd be kidnapped or killed. And the pressure that he was under when he came into the major leagues, I believe it was in 1947, 48, those 3 years took years off his life, literally. Jackie Robinson was 53 years old when he died. By the time he got to middle age, he was blind, he had heart problems, he had diabetes, and by all accounts, from his family and friends, the stress of what he endured in those 3 to 4 years killed him, shortened his life. But we move forward. Jackie Robinson, who was a stalwart for civil rights, but also understood the need to be silent, to not scream. And he came into conflict with a man named Martin Luther King. This Martin Luther King had said, enough is enough. We can't wait anymore. And Jackie Robinson said, look, I am with you. I agree with you. This is the way we have to go. But you're going too fast. You're being too audacious. You're going to get us all killed. There's another way we can do this. Joe Louis was another person who was silent, but in his heart of hearts, worked behind the scenes for civil rights. Dr. King said, no, no, we can't wait anymore. We can't wait another hour, another minute, another day. And so we go forward in the civil rights movement to the 1960s, to the last few months of Dr. King's life. There was a situation where sanitation workers were basically treated like chattel. And so in February of 68 began what would become the Poor Man's Campaign. And so that campaign was about the ability to scream, the ability to speak up, the ability to be men. There was another figure during that time, a few years earlier, by the name of Malcolm X. And Malcolm X stirred the pot up quite a bit. And there was a movie that was done in 1992 by Spike Lee, based on the autobiography of Malcolm X, written by Alex Haley. And there's a poignant scene at the end of the movie where Nelson Mandela speaks about Malcolm. It's important to say about this clip that first, a director, Norman Jewison, wanted to do the movie. And he had credentials to do a movie on the autobiography of Malcolm X because he did a movie called The Soldier Story that starred a number of black stars and was actually an excellent film. But Spike Lee spoke up and said, no, I insist that someone African-American do the film, so that the film speaks authentically. Now, I don't necessarily take this point of view. When Quincy Jones approached Steven Spielberg about doing The Color Purple, Steven Spielberg was hesitant. You know, I don't know if I can really do this, and I don't know if I understand a black experience. And Quincy Jones said to him, well, You didn't have to go to Mars to make E.T. He said, you have a point. But what's notable about this is that Mr. Mandela would not say the words by any means necessary, because during that time, he had just gotten out of prison. They were organizing their new government in South Africa, and he had concerns about saying anything that could damage or jeopardize that transition. So here's this man who spent 27 years in prison, was the icon of liberation and freedom. And even he, in the late 20th century, was still afraid to speak with his authentic voice, which I think is important to note. For me, that is the most iconic image of Mr. Obama's presidency. The woman is Jan Brewer. She's the governor of Arizona. The governor was responsible for passing just a real draconian anti-immigration law that said that law enforcement had the right to approach any person based on suspicion and ask them for their papers to prove that they're citizens of the United States, or they could be deported. Obviously, the Obama administration was opposed to that. But he went on a political visit to Arizona, and the governor met him on the tarmac. And what can only be called one of the more disrespectful things I've ever seen, well, of course, there'll be more. She's pointing in his face, which she did intentionally, and she wanted that photograph. And many people were overjoyed at that photo because they always felt that the president was too uppity, that he was outside of his station, and that someone was finally putting him in his place. Governor Brewer was asked about that moment. How dare the President of the United States speak authoritatively to me? When have you ever heard anything like that from a governor of all people? So when President Obama was running for election, his opponent was John McCain. And there had become this hysteria at these events, these rallies, where he was accused of palling around with terrorists, where he was accused of being un-American in any way, where people were venting and crying that their country is being taken away. It was Armageddon and the end of the world as we know it. Okay, so it's not playing. So in this clip, a gentleman talks about how he is terrified of the Obama administration and that he's fearful of what may happen if President Obama is elected. And then John McCain goes on to say, well, I know President Obama, and you have nothing to fear. We disagree with each other on the issues, but he's a good man. Then a woman comes up in another famous moment and says, I've read these things about President Obama, and he scares me. He's an Arab. No, ma'am. No, ma'am. He's not an Arab. He's a fine man. He's a fine gentleman, family man. We just disagree on the issues. I think I'd be a better president. Of course, the first thing I'd say is, well, what if you happen to be an Arab? What's wrong with being an Arab? He answered the question like, no, he's an okay guy. He's not an Arab. And so there was just this hysteria going on, and this hysteria had gotten to a point of just craziness. So the National Rifle Association began this campaign saying that Barack Obama was the greatest threat to gun rights in the history of mankind. And a record number of weapons were purchased after the election of Barack Obama. But also beyond that, one thing that led people to go to their guns was the idea that health care is a right and not a privilege. And so, because we want to be more like Canada, people feel they need to be armed and come to healthcare rallies. And those healthcare discussions that summer, Congress people were frightened for their lives. I mean, the screaming and the threats that they received were just, it's unbelievable. You would have thought that we were somehow, you know, becoming communist China or something. And at these rallies, you would see these images. This is actually a pretty famous image of Obama as a witch doctor. And then, of course, we should be impeached because we want to bring health care insurance to 40 million people who are uninsured. But then, of course, you have people who got even more bold, and in this example, there is a video is called, a song called Barack the Magic Negro, which is a parody of Puff the Magic Dragon that Rush Limbaugh, conservative talk show host, put on the air. And it goes, Barack the Magic Negro. And so the purpose of the song, the insult, of course, obviously, to the president, and he tried to explain it by saying, no, I wasn't making fun of the president. I was talking about Al Sharpton and how he perceives the president to be. And which I don't think is any better, but it reminds me of a story of when I was at Notre Dame, and my roommate came up to me, and he was angry because he felt the football players, and he meant the black football players, were arrogant. And he said, you know, Steve, I don't have a problem with you, because I was on the football team at the time. He says, as far as I'm concerned, you're white. And he thought he was paying me a compliment. And then it just really kind of brought it to light for me that I don't know what it was, that because I didn't walk around sticking my chest out or for whatever reason, that I was acceptable. I was a credit to my race, whatever that means. And so, but you know, that kind of disrespect was not just limited to conservatives. Obviously, that comment didn't prevent the president from making Joe Biden his vice president. But even in a situation like that, it's sort of like he has to take the insult and then be gracious in return. And that's what really racism is about in the modern era, is that you prove that you're not race conscious or that you're not a race baiter by your ability to withstand racial assault. And that by just simply pointing at racism, you are therefore the racist. And so it reminds me of when I was in my jazz class at Notre Dame. It was a history of jazz taught by a priest, Father George Waskirkin, the late George Waskirkin. And he started the class by talking about how comparing European music to African music, saying that European music is polished and smooth and scholarly and clean, whereas African music is dirty and, you know, schizophrenic and is sort of not structured. And he said it wasn't as an insult, it's just, you know, it's more improvisational. You know, for instance, what is improvisation? I could be up here and I could decide that I'm going to have a talk about watermelon. Now, I don't know anything about watermelon, and watermelon isn't necessarily something I'm an expert at, but, you know, just improvising, I want to talk about watermelon. And then he went on to talk about how he was in a black church one time, and it started at 7 o'clock CPT, which is colored people's time. So here I am at Notre Dame, and here's a priest that's saying this, you know. And there were about five or six black students in the class, and we just, obviously, anyone else, if it had been probably a group of Jewish students or Italian students or any other students, they would have probably said, what? If it had been something against them. But we knew that we were sort of alone in the room and we self-censored. Now, that eventually became the root of our own student protest. But in the moment of when it really counted, the self-censorship came in. And so let's try this again. So the president, Skip Gates, famous Harvard professor, lost his keys, tried to get in the house, broke into his own house. Someone from the neighborhood calls the police. The police come, enter the home. He shows ID. They have an argument. He gets arrested. And the president says that the police acted stupidly. Well, which caused an uproar because, I mean, the logic says, yes, he did act stupidly in that regard. And then he doubled down when he spoke to the reporter saying, I don't understand the controversy here. And you think, okay, well, it ends there. Not so much. So this is the famous, the audio's not working, this is the famous beer summit So afterwards, the president then bows down to pressure, backs off, and says, okay, let's all have a beer summit and talk about race or whatever. And so the police officer who's coming up then says, President Obama should apologize to all policemen everywhere. Okay, so, and because that police officers are in unions, and unions are a big Democratic voting bloc, and the majority of policemen, you know, tend to come from white ethnic groups, which are Reagan Democrats, you get this situation where now he's apologizing for what he said. So moving on, and I am going to move through these pretty quickly. We go to the whole issue of where was he born? And so you have Donald Trump, very famous man, one of the more famous people, talking who's running for president, and the issue of his birth comes up. I'm going to stop it there. And you can see that when he's talking, he has to pause. And then it's this moment of, I can't believe I'm standing up here doing this. The President of the United States has to stand before the seal to the world and say, here's proof that I was born in the United States. It would be comical. And in every case where he talked about the Skip Gates situation, where he talked about Jan Brewer, he has to laugh and use humor in order to get through it, because if you don't, you would scream. And so here's the birth certificate posted for anyone to see that Barack Hussein Obama was born in Hawaii. But that's not enough. And so now the question becomes that he's so illegitimate that maybe he didn't even go to school where he said he went to school. And so it reminds, you know, when I was in fifth grade, there was a substitute teacher, and he was a World War II veteran. And he talked about, he gave us some incredible war stories. And so after that, I raised my hand. I said, my grandfather was in the war too. And he said, well, no, your grandfather couldn't have been in the war. Well, why not? Well, blacks weren't allowed to fight in the war, which it wasn't true. My grandfather was on Guam. I mean, they weren't allowed necessarily to be in infantry, but they could drive supply trucks and they were cooks and that. But the point of the matter is that for that split second, for that moment, for that day, I questioned my grandfather because I chose to believe him when he challenged my grandfather's legitimacy as a World War II veteran. And so, you know, there's an example, which I'll skip, where a United States congressman made a comparison to Barack Obama, calling him, it's sort of like being a tar baby. You don't eat your hands dirty. But one moment that I thought was very important to talk about, and so now people are blatantly just calling him boy. And Pat Buchanan served in the Nixon White House. Rush Limbaugh, who has tens of millions of radio listeners, they're not even hiding it anymore. And the president says nothing. He doesn't respond. And so now you get unprecedented situations where foreign leaders from other countries can come to the United States and disrespect the president on American soil. And so he said unprecedented. Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, came to the United States, had that meeting with Obama, went before a joint session of Congress, and then began to lobby actively against the president's foreign policy in regards to a two-state solution between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Numerous standing ovations. Actually, Bibi Netanyahu got more standing ovations than the president did during the State of the Union address. And I just don't think you would have seen something like that from other presidents. So for the sake of your sanity, I'm going to jump through and get to actually the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich.
Obama is the best food stamp president in American history. More people are in food stamps today because of Obama's policy than ever in history. I would like to be the best paycheck president in American history. Now, there's no neighborhood I know of in America where if you went around and asked people, would you rather your children had food stamps or paychecks, you wouldn't end up with a majority saying they'd rather have a paycheck. And so I'm prepared, if the NAACP invites me, I'll go to their convention and talk about why the African American community should demand paychecks and not be satisfied with food stamps.
First of all, there are more white people on food stamps than in anyone in the United States. Second of all, if the former Speaker of the House can say things like this, then you give license to anyone to say anything at any time. And so well, here's my hope. My hope is that what we have here is a situation where the agreement 2012, Branch Rickey said to Jackie Robinson, for 3 years, you can't respond, but after 3 years, you're on your own. After those 3 years, Jackie Robinson cursed people out. He slid hard to second base with his spikes. He gave it back to the crowd. He didn't care anymore. He let it all hang out. He stole a base whenever he felt like it because, you know, he couldn't steal a base all the time, even though he was lightning fast, because he couldn't show up the catcher. That kind of nonsense that he had to deal with. So what I'm hoping is that Barack Obama's second term will be similar to that, to where once he gets his second term and has nothing to lose, we will be able to see a president who can scream. And so you saw a little taste of that recently. So when that happened, it was a glimpse into the president's life. Michelle Obama, the first lady, went on and talked on television and talked about how he sings to her all the time. Now, this is something that you wouldn't see from President Obama. As a matter of fact, you know, we're seeing a glimpse into what I hope his second term will be, that he will be able to be more of his authentic self. And so we come to, for me, an example of what it means to scream in the 21st century for an African American. I'm giving you a language warning. Now, I apologize for the language, but I had another version of this where I bleeped the things out. And as I was bleeping, I bleeped the F word, the S word, but I left nigger because I wanted to make a point. And so then I had to ask myself the question, what was it inside of me where it was okay for you to hear nigger, but not okay to hear fucking shit? I don't have an answer to that yet, but that self-censoring is still going on, and I'm dealing with that, so I'm making a confession in that regard. So what is all of this about, really? And I think it's something important in being from the African-American community, being a church-based culture, that I can show you this. This is from the book of Isaiah, A Man of Sorrows. And it talks about the Christ figure. Jesus Christ is a person who takes on the sins of the world, who is beaten and scourged and despised for the sake of love. He is despised and rejected by man, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and he hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed. Excuse me. So in this verse, you have the embodiment of the black experience. The wearing of the mask, taking on pain, suffering, and yet coming through that suffering, resurrection, so to speak. And so African Americans feel this affinity for this president because they don't see weakness where his liberal white friends see weakness when he does not speak. His liberal white friends, who are sometimes more hurtful than helpful, because they want him so desperately to be this Messiah figure that they were hoping for. And when he appears weak or docile, they turn on him. And liberals have turned on him. But I understand, and my grandmother understands, that this was necessary. That is an icon, an Orthodox icon called extreme humility. That Christ comes to earth, takes on human form, and humbles himself and suffers with us. And these are figures, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Emmett Till, Jackie Robinson, who all in one way or another martyred themselves, or not by his choice, obviously, for the sake of us all of us, not just black people. And so when we see Barack Obama, that is what we see. That is the icon that's buried deep in our souls. That is the imagery that calls to us from centuries ago. And that is the icon that gives many hope, because they know in their heart of hearts that this has a good ending. Maybe not in our lifetimes, but it does have a good ending. And so we come to that photo again. What do you see when you look at that photo? Hopefully you see something different than you saw before you walked in this room. I have my disagreements with our president. I happen to disagree with the fact that he has encoded in law the right to assassinate American citizens anywhere at any time. I happen to think he was too easy on the Wall Street banks. I have a number of arguments with him. But I do know this. He is a man who is fully human and knows his humanity and knows who he is, and he is a much better man than I. I could not endure what he's endured, nor would I want to. And I hurt for him that we still live in a society where he has to endure this. So what I would ask of all of you in your daily dealings when you speak about the president, because he's our president, he's your president, he's my president, it doesn't matter that you're Canadian, because what he represents is something much more than borders, much more than political parties, much more than a red Tory tradition or a Democratic and Republican tradition. What he represents is our humanity, our ability to wear our humanity, our ability to understand and sympathize and empathize and love one another. He's emblematic of all those things. Not because he's a Messiah figure or because he's perfect or there's anything great about him. It's because of where the world is now. We live in times where we are witnessing a paradigm shift, a global economic crisis that nearly brought us to our knees, disasters everywhere, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, climate change, warmest winter in 80 years in Chicago. We have to reorient our thinking and how we organize our society. And we're only going to do that if we begin to have serious, tough dialogue and ask some serious questions and challenge people when they show the ugliness of who we are instead of the beauty of who we can be. And finally, that's my son and my daughter. That's Joshua and that's Emily. This picture is from a few years ago. He's 15 now and she's 6. I marvel that Barack Obama is the only president she has ever known. No matter what happens to him, whether he gets a second term or not, whether history judges it as a successful term, that imprint, that icon is buried in her forever. And not just for little black girls, but for little white girls. We had a historic election where a black man from Kenya ran against a socialist radical woman in the Democratic primaries in Hillary Clinton. Either a white woman or a black man is going to become president of the United States. It can happen. My son, he's all matter-of-factly about it. He remembers Bill Clinton vaguely, but no big deal to him. That should be insulting, but it's not. I'm glad it's not a big deal to him. I'm glad he's matter-of-factly about it. And in them lies our hope. I want to thank you for your patience. I'm embarrassed that the technical difficulties cropped up, but hopefully you're able to hear authentically what's inside of me. And it's been a privilege to share this with you. And it is such a blessing to be amongst you. I find this country such an incredible place. Watching how both countries developed over the centuries in different ways and similar ways. The way that you treat decent, basic humanity of health care for all as a right, that is stunning to me. What you take as matter-of-factly in my country, there are people who think that sick people should die if they can't afford health care. At the Republican debates, people cheered when the question was asked, well, what should a person do if they don't have health insurance? Should we just let them die? Yay! I find that to be utter barbarism. In this country, you think that people who love one another, regardless of their orientation, should have the right to love one another. I'm conflicted about a great many things in my faith, in my personal life. But I do know this. I am thankful for the shining example that you all are in this country of what true humanity can be. And I hope that you don't lose that. I'm concerned about your country. I hope you don't lose it. So thank you all again. And thank you for indulging me.
Thanks so much, Steve.